to yet another edition of Britainology. I'm Milo Edwards, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Nate Bethay.
Hello, it's a lovely day in London. It's warm-ish and sunny, unusually sunny. Cycled in today.
Suspiciously sunny.
I've seen some really, really strange, incredibly British things in recent trips.
Oh, no.
Not going to lie.
Oh, dear.
The other day, I was cycling in, and I saw a guy who legitimately looked like Karl Marx. Except, imagine kind of hench, yeah, like jacked.
He's
Karl Marx
from Highgate.
So he was unloading. He was using a what we'd call a dolly cart to unload a truck in front of a Sainsbury's local. But he had like fully white hair, but like the blown out kind of pyramid of hair and the big beard and everything like that. Absolutely, like
dolly full of linen coats.
Exactly, just jacked Karl Marx. wild stuff, man.
So just Karl Marx.
Yeah. There were a couple other things too. You know, invariably this time of year, you just, I've said it on numerous other shows. I've been on to the point where I can't even remember if I'm repeating myself that when people start coming out and more people start cycling and stuff, it feels like London's AI is glitching because so much more shit is just kind of thrown at you all over the place as opposed to between lockdown and cold weather, folks were kind of staying off the road. So.
Yeah, and as we know, Britain is kind of like an RPG. There are only so many faces that it has, so you start seeing people over and over
exactly.
again.
Exactly, just keep repeating over and over
same
again.
Same guys. We do love that.
Well, it's funny you should mention something involving the same guys.
The same guy, indeed. Today, we are going to talk about the Cray twins. Famous British fucking gangsters. Dave Courtney's gay dads, the Cray twins.
Yeah, exactly. They loved their moms. They never hurt anybody. I mean, they did hurt some people, but...
But now one who didn't deserve it.
Exactly.
I'm glad that you're aware of the they loved their mom thing about the Crays. They looked after their mom.
You've mentioned that to me before, and also we talked about it with Dave Courtney specifically on the first episode of Britainology, where the guy tried to say he never hurt anyone and then had to stop himself because he realized that is emphatically not true.
Yeah, never hurt anyone, it wasn't a wrong one. He only hurts nonces.
Exactly. So we got to watch a film featuring bisexual icon Tom Hardy basically playing both roles. Of both Ronnie and Reggie Cray.
Yeah, they were identical twins.
Filmed in what looked like right next door to our old studio in and around here in Whitechapel. And I'm not going to say it was a good movie, but I do think that there was a certain degree of high budget attention to detail in trying to recreate London of the time. And it was a film about geezers.
A film about geezers, slags, cunts, mugs, all the different shades of guy that you can get.
And, what's important to remember here is that this is a true story. The film might have been fictionalized, et cetera, but it is a true story of a thing that used to exist, which is a sort of geezer mafia in London of guys running protection rackets, casinos, et cetera.
Pub Nostra.
Yeah, and just our the forebears of a kind of Cockney legend of hard men running London, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, as the film is called, Legend.
Legends, exactly.
People do love, I mean, we'll get into like the general British public opinions about the Crays, because I think the way that the British people relate to like organized crime in the East End is fascinating. But on the subject of stressing that it's a true story, I saw this film when it came out in the cinema in Moscow. And I went with my flatmate, Lyosha, he'd been to university in the UK, so he spoke really good English. We were sat there, kind of. He's like muddling through with understanding the film despite the inscrutable accents and slang. And then at some point we're kind of like chatting in the cinema, and it became apparent to me that he didn't realize that these were like real guys. He was like, oh, this is like a fun story. I'm like, no, this is all like real. And they were friends with like half of like all the British celebrities of the time.
Soviet Union was correct. Britain is debased country.
That's right. Exactly.
To be fair to your friend, I also struggled with the accents. About 5 minutes into the film, I turned to Milo and said, could we please turn the subtitles on? Because much like the first time I saw Trainspotting, I was understanding what was going on, but there were a lot of, let's call them, nuances being lost on me because it was just so fucking Cockney. And also my hearing's not as good as it used to be. And so you combine that with some deeply, deeply English accents, and I struggle with it.
he's gone a bit deaf and now geezers are out of his hearing range. I transmit at a certain frequency.
Frequency of crime.
Yeah. I'm on deeply geezer wavelength because Nate knows this, but I picked up my car this morning. And of course, this is a deeply geezer experience dealing with car dealers.
Used car dealers
used
in Essex.
Used car dealers. Oh, absolutely. In Romford, the heart of like geezer country these days. This is like the people who live in Romford now are like the people who lived in the East End in the time when this was set. This is kind of like, I mean, as we know, working in the East End has changed a lot since the days of geezers who will have a punch up in the pub.
They are still here, but in smaller numbers, obviously, because the demographics have changed a lot. Tower Hamlets as a borough is still majority white, but like that's because there's so much of a mix of people in the borough. But like,
yeah, because Tower Hamlets includes like Wapping and like other places that aren't really what you think of necessarily. But as the
my experience
East End.
In places like Shadwell is that when you go there, you will encounter lots of really, really old Cockneys. Mm-hmm. And basically, it feels like the majority of people there are Bengali.
Yeah.
So that was in the 1960s not the case. Then this thing called Essex happened.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Everyone moved out to Essex, and the story of Milo begins there.
In America, you had white flight, and here we had geezer flight. That was that's the truest
it's more
form.
Air. There's more free space for crime.
Yeah.
It's too crowded.
So, just in general about the... I mean, I'm not going to pretend I know loads about the Crazies. I'm just on their Wikipedia now, and I noticed that the picture on their Wikipedia is a portrait of them that was done by David Bailey, who's like a really famous British photographer. So, I'm kind of... This is the kind of the thing about the Crazies, which I think the film gets across a bit, but like, yeah, there's the way in which there were like... Everyone at sort of the top of British society, or at least like kind of celebrities, were like just very happy to like hobnob with them. Like Barbara Windsor, who died recently, who's like a very famous actress of that period, was like huge mates with the Crays.
It does strike me that, and correct me if I'm off base here, that there's a sort of desire for authenticity that British people feel this kind of when they encounter people who aren't just, to use a Britishism, just tedious cunts like themselves, they kind of gravitate towards that. I think that, and it manifests itself in different kinds of neuroses about authenticity in one way or the other, whether it's, call it the sort of symptom of the larger FBPE disease, kind of like manifesting that desire of wanting to be something else or wanting to identify with something else.
The Crays show up in your pub to intimidate you with a load of golden retrievers, and they're like, yeah, we're having a wooferendum. We run this pub now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just imagining FBPE Ronnie Cray, just like...
Oh, God.
This country is better in than out. I can't even fucking do it, man.
I don't know what that accent was.
I can't even fucking do it. I just... Yeah. Invariably...
It's called a fucking Portuguese custard tart. Don't like it as at all.
Yeah, I mean, but then at the same time, too, you'll encounter this with people, you know... There is that fixation, I think, with a lot of British expats who wind up in the United States, for example, that like they're really into the stuff that gives America, call it sort of scare quotes, authenticity of music, culture, et cetera, and that kind of a thing. And so it doesn't surprise me that people would want to gravitate towards something with, let's call it like notoriety, you know, in the sense
absolutely.
Of just sort of seeing the authentic item, if you will.
Yeah.
Here are people who are absolutely criminals who are violent, but not in a like slasher film way. Like they're just they're gangsters. And I mean, I don't know if you had, I couldn't tell you if you had a similar thing, but I think you kind of did in America with like, for example,
Frank Sinatra
being friends with like Sam Giancana and stuff like that.
I'm reading this here. Apparently, they hung out with Frank Sinatra as well.
Well, what you have to understand is that Frank Sinatra was Sicilian, so like those are all his people.
Hey, whoa!
Like in a huge, huge way. He may have had blue eyes, but he was Sicilian, and so as a result, there's just this. But there were similar things too. I mean, one of the big conspiracies around JFK was that like he was friends with Frank Sinatra and Sam Giancana and like dated a woman that also was dating Sam Giancana and stuff like that. And Sam Giancana was a Sicilian gangster who was like a big guy in Chicago, that kind of a thing. So like you did have a similar phenomenon, but I think that because of the fact that the UK is a smaller country and that everything is so London centric, you know, it's sort of everyone who's doing shit is here.
Yeah.
for better or for worse.
Yeah, I mean, there was
to make Birmingham happen. In our hearts, we really want to make Birmingham happen. But like, for the time being, this country is very London-centric. Yeah.
There was similar, I think there were similar sort of kind of geezer vibes, crime rackets up and down the country. I mean, yeah. You get a bit more of that in kind of like Guy Ritchie is a bit more interested in that, or like Layer Cake, where there's lots of stuff about like, but actually both Guy Ritchie and that film Layer Cake are very, like they always bring in Scousers for some reason. They're always about, whenever they're getting someone down from out of London, it's always Liverpool.
Definitely.
I remember actually when I was a teenager and Liverpool was like really notoriously bad for gang crime. It was like people were getting shot a lot in Liverpool. But it seems fine now. Don't really hear anything about Liverpool, so I assume it's fine.
But then again, I mean, similarly, Glasgow had its own sort of, as I understand it, crime reputation, but that was less an organized crime thing. Although there were sort of rackets and the mob and shit like that.
It was just Francis Begbie.
But there also was like, yeah, you know, there's the random stabbings. And then you think of something like Peaky Blinders that is Birmingham and similarly like crime shit, you know, social dysfunction, incredible poverty, and just like a bunch of geezers. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, it's like everything in the UK, everything's so localized. I mean, again, this comes up in the film, but like how like the Krays are running East London, but the Richardsons, who are another real gang who existed, are running South London. And there's like a constant sort of turf war about if any of them show up in a pub north of the river, the Krays are furious about it. The Richardsons had this guy who doesn't really come up much in the film, but this guy called Mad Frankie Fraser, who's another like incredibly famous British gangster that people like to talk about in these kind of like, oh, Frankie, yeah, he was all right terms. And they called him Mad Frankie Fraser for a reason.
Yeah, I was going to say nominative determinism.
To Mr. and Mrs. Frankie Fraser, a son, Mad.
Well, I mean, I remember... hearing that name and, yeah, you know, hearing stories about that being the case too, that, well, I mean, there's the whole scandal, isn't there, that like there was a ton of organized crime in London and there was also the police were famously corrupt. And so, you know, that was kind of a breeding ground for that stuff. And it's like in the United States, you had the exact same thing going on. Yeah. It's just everyone was Italian. But it's the same sort of thing. You know, you had the New York mob and the Chicago mob and the Las Vegas being run openly by the mob and stuff like that. Yeah. And that changed in the 70s and particularly in the 80s, these guys started to get prosecuted. The big one was in the US at least, and I don't know what it's like here, was that because the mob got involved with drug trafficking.
Right.
You know, that had been kind of like a thing that wasn't, they didn't really touch. And then they realized how much money they could make from it. Thing was, post the start of the war on drugs under Reagan, these guys that used to be facing 5-10 year sentences for whatever dumb bullshit they were doing as mobsters were now looking at 40, 50, 60 years in prison for drug sentencing and stuff like that. And so a lot of people turned and flipped and stuff. And the mob lost all of its power relative to what it had previously had. It still exists, but, you know, if you think about like the level of crime that they get up to in The Sopranos in terms of like, you know, they're not exactly like...
Mostly bullying a guy who owns a sports store.
Yeah, defrauding a sports store, stealing some cars and selling them to Italians, bringing actual Italians over to do physical crimes for them. A little stuff here and there with some front businesses.
Pushing Webistics.
Yeah, getting construction companies to put, you know, no-show jobs on the books for them and stuff like that. Mm. Very small scale stuff compared to like running the gambling center of America. You know, so it did exist in the 60s in America and like it doesn't to any great degree anymore.
No, exactly. And then, yeah, so basically like before we get into the film itself, kind of, the Krays were like big in the kind of 50s and 60s. At the end of the 60s, they both went to prison for life. Ronnie died in prison in 1995 and Reggie died in 2000. He got let out on compassionate release like a few weeks earlier. So that's kind of their period of activity. Yeah, so the film starts out... Reggie is out on the town being a gangster. Ronnie is in a secure mental unit because he is paranoid schizophrenic. Reggie manages to have a psychiatrist bullied into declaring him fit for release, during which time he has begun trying to charm a local Cockney lass, Frances, whose mother doesn't approve of Reggie because he is a gangster. But he insists that he's just a club owner.
Exactly. And he does various romantic gestures, like asking her if he can suck on the candy she's currently sucking on.
Yeah.
At one point, climbing,
this is Cockney kink.
At one point, climbing up the rain spout or the gutter spout to propose to her, taking her to the club, leaving her at the table with one of his henchmen for a moment while he punches a guy in the face, and then comes back to show her an evening and have like a sort of mock philosophical conversation about the center of the world is wherever you want it to be, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so he's just got to go and punch a guy in the face. You know, that happens. Sometimes a little bit of business, a little bit of pleasure at once. It happens to the best of us. Yeah, there's kind of a running thing throughout the film where there's this one guy that works for them.
Jack.
Jack the Hat, Jack McVitie, who is always doing something that pisses off Reggie, and Reggie always gives him a cigarette and then punches him in the face.
Yeah.
Which is a fun little visual gag.
The third time he winds up physically accosting him, a slightly more serious,
a slightly less funny incident.
Exactly.
He's dating Francis. They get married. And he then gets put in prison for, well, actually this happens before they get married, but he gets put in prison for this previous thing that he was on a warrant for, which they don't really explain what it was.
It sounded like he had been, like, the sentence had been suspended, but they decided to unsuspend it, so he wound up having to serve the last 6 months of his sentence in prison. So he goes to prison, the cops beat him up. He then manages to fake, you know, grovel, snatch a pair of handcuffs from the cop, handcuff him to the bars, and beat the fuck out of him.
Yeah.
Earning the respect of the prisoners that was already there to begin with, and then getting him beaten to complete shit. However, you know, he's established dominance in prison this way because he's
absolutely
Reggie Cray.
Becoming the alpha in prison. Again, that was one of the things where I kind of wondered, like, how sort of accurate that was, on the basis that, like, the film sort of simultaneously is like, oh yeah, the Krays are these, like, notorious criminals, like, everyone knows who they are, they, like, run London or whatever, but also that, like, Reggie Cray feels like he has to establish dominance when he gets in prison, when it's like, well, presumably not.
Yeah, and also it's one of those things where, you know, particularly back then, no matter how famous a celebrity gangster you were, it's probably safe to assume that if you pissed off the cops in prison enough, they'd probably murder you. Like, they kind of could, but it's just one of those things where it's a film, you know, they take creative license.
How many flat-nosed geezers you got in?
Exactly.
Well, that's all that matters.
That was the thing, is that he had 501 flat-nosed geezers, and they couldn't take on an army like that. If it had been 500 or fewer, they wouldn't have thought twice about murdering him, you know?
That's what happened to Dave. They couldn't handle a man with that much power.
Exactly. No, it's just the magic number. Yeah. Italian-sized geezer element.
Lieutenant Colonel Dave Courtney and his battalion of geezers. So he gets out of prison. Francis makes him promise her that he is not going to go back to prison. But meanwhile, while he's been in there, Ron, his twin brother, who is still a paranoid schizophrenic, has been doing some interesting things with the business.
He tries to hand his stand-up. Bombs it pretty hard. Scares away everybody from the club because he's a psycho. Wants to build a utopian city in Nigeria called Enugu.
North FC shit.
I have no idea if that's actually historically accurate. Like, if he had some harebrained scheme along those lines, but...
I don't know. I think there's definitely... It's sort of implied that he had endless harebrained schemes.
Yeah, fair.
I don't know whether that particular one was true or whether that was more meant to give a general sense of what he was like.
I would just say that whom among us cannot relate to the idea of having to chase after a completely unhinged sibling who's constantly getting themselves into scrapes? I know nothing about this.
Yeah, no one knows anything about this. There's a bit, I think, which comes earlier in the film than this, where they're in a sort of minor turf war with the Richardson gang, and the Richardsons suggest that they have like a little meeting to call a truce at this pub called the Pig and Whistle, which I found funny in and of itself, which is supposedly on neutral territory. I'm not sure, they don't really say where the pub is, but and the Cray twins show up, and it's like, the Richardsons aren't there, but they've just sent some guys to, like, beat them up. And then Ronnie makes a show of Zoe has two shotguns in his coat pocket and manages to walk out. And then they say they're going to beat up Reggie. And he is talking about, all right, fine, let's have a fight then. And then Ronnie comes in with two hammers and begins setting about everyone in the bar. They have a fight. The Kray twins win. During which time, though, they refer to the guys that the Richardson sent as a bunch of nonces. which... did amuse me. I thought, you know, it's true. Much like the life of the Krays does have some handshake memes with being on Twitter. So, you know.
Fair, yeah. I mean, well, being Flash, calling people nonces, one person being decidedly better at posting than the other. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are some similarities there.
Absolutely. What if there were four identical twins and they were all the trash shoot show guys?
Well, there's actually five of us, but oh, yeah. We've forgotten.
One can't be identical. A fraternal twin, Alice.
Exactly.
So when Reggie gets out of prison, him and Ron have this big confrontation at the club because it's Friday night and there's barely anyone in there. And it turns out that, yeah, Ron has scared away all the customers and, like, extorted loads of money, embezzled loads of money, rather, out of the business. And so the business is all in trouble. They have a big fist fight in the bar. I don't know how they shot Tom Hardy having a fist fight with himself.
Yeah.
Technically quite impressive. But it's sort of played for laughs. It's, like, really, like, there's sort of, like, there's a bit where Ronnie is, like, grabbing his balls. He's like, oh, come on, Ron, not like that.
Yeah, there is a certain level of the boys are at it again, as opposed to, well, I mean, here are two insane people who could absolutely kill each other. And Reggie ends the fight by breaking a champagne bottle over Ronnie's head.
Yeah.
It is not good.
Pretty classic, yeah. Breaking a champagne bottle, as someone said. Yeah, during the fight, actually, one of the characters, one of the guys who works for them, I can't remember, I think they call him Big Pat. Whose character is just that he is very large. He's like, I'm going to separate them. They're going to fucking kill each other. And they're like, no, you got to let him do this.
It's funny you should mention Big Pat, because Big Pat is bald and big and is the doorman at their club. And I, as I said to Milo as we were watching this, this seems to suggest that that there's just an archetype of Dave Courtney that occurs throughout history. That whatever your crime operation, there will always be a bald doorman who is just a big guy.
Yeah.
And that's all you need.
Except that Big Pat is like double the size of Dave Courtney.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, Dave Courtney is wide, but he's not tall.
He's not particularly tall, is he? And Big Pat absolutely is. So we have, you have the henchmen like Albie and Big Pat and...
Yeah, most of the henchmen look a bit like Brian Ferry or other members of Roxy Music, apart from Big Pat, who is like the gigantic bald guy who looks like he could crush your head like a melon.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone else just looks like they lacked vitamins as children.
Albie is the guy who's like Reggie's main like fixer, right? The guy who says like you just stabbed a guy in a room full of people. Are you fucking mad?
Yeah,
that guy.
I think
he's the one who I was thinking of. Who looks like Brian Ferry.
Yeah. Well, then there's also the Scottish guy too, isn't there?
Oh yeah.
There's two guys who are like skinny, just sort of like leathery skin looking guys, and one of them
basically the same.
One of them's Scottish and one of them's not. Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a diverse gang of geezers from different parts of the United Kingdom in this. I don't know how accurate that is. I mean, I presume they're mostly based on real people, because like Big Pat is clearly supposed to be Northern. He's got like a Yorkshire accent.
Yeah, that's true. To be honest with you,
you're not the voice I did, but
you're better at picking up on that than I am. Oftentimes, when it gets super Cockney, unless like there's a very very obvious Northern vowel drop, like I sometimes cannot tell them all apart. I'm getting better at it. I mean, I'm better at it in the sense now that when someone points something out, like the guy who grows the enormous vegetables who lives in Oxfordshire has kind of a West Country accent.
Oh, yeah.
Someone
asked
me once, like,
Gerald,
what the fuck is that accent? I'm like, honestly, that's West Country-ish. I mean, but I imagine a guy that old, it's possible he might have been born and raised in Oxfordshire and just talks that
old
way.
Old school West Oxfordshire, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like rural Oxfordshire, like proper Oxfordshire types. It's like, I mean,
yeah.
So there's lots of like posh home counties people who have houses in Oxfordshire and they commute to London or whatever, but like proper, proper Oxfordshire is like, all right.
Yeah. And obviously like Scouse is pretty distinct, so you can tell. And Geordie's pretty distinct too,
because
I can't understand any of it. So
Geordie is quite something. Yeah, that is. It's hard to do as well, because I think Geordie is so they have so much of their own slang.
Yeah.
And like ways of like they call cigarettes tabs and stuff like that. And it's just very like the way a whole way of speaking is like it's like a proper dialect, Geordie. There were some good bits of Cockney slang in this, but I can't remember now. I think they didn't put too much rhyming slang in it because I think they thought for an international audience it would just be too confusing.
I do appreciate that, as far as I'm aware, Tom Hardy did not grow up with Cockney family or speaking with a Cockney accent, but he managed to do a much better job than...
I don't know where Tom Hardy's from, actually.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know much about him. He's English, but I don't know where he's from, and he did do quite a good job of that.
For sake of professionalism, let's open
Let's mid-episode recording open Wikipedia.
Absolutely.
I feel like that's the nature. We don't have to leave everyone guessing.
Oh, would you look at that? His real name is Edward Hardy. Ed Hardy.
Yeah, well, he couldn't have
that. I didn't know he was in Black Hawk Down.
Oh, yeah. He's very, very young in that. I think he Orlando Bloom
was born in London.
The private who falls off the thing, who's very, very young too, but I can't remember what...
He was born in Hammersmith. So I think it is fair to say that he is not... Yeah, he brought up in Eastsheen and attended Tower House School. Yeah, this is not a Cockney man.
Yeah, for the sake of explaining this to our non-British listeners,
Eastsheen is like, well, because where he actually grew up is like bougie. It's like, that's like Richmond Park, that's sort of down where, like Zach Goldsmith lives there.
Hammersmith is in West London, so yeah. For the purpose of definition, because this was something I didn't really get until I spent time in the UK, Cockney almost invariably means East London, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you consider someone who is just like extreme South London geezer to be Cockney or no?
In the broader sense of the word, like, so technically speaking, Cockney means born within the sound of the Bow Bells. So you have to be in like quite a small area of East London. But like in general sense, kind of London geezer is generally considered Cockney. So be it like North or South London, it's sort of like kind of the same. The culture is the same. It's the same slang. It's the same shit. But it's like kind of the East End is sort of the traditional vibe.
Which is basically where we are right now. We're literally on Brick Lane. Like, you don't get more obnoxiously
it's pretty,
East London
pretty
than where
Cockney
we are.
Around here. I don't know if you can hear the Bow Bells even from here.
That is a good point.
But I mean, this is definitely like proper... I mean, like we were saying, most of the film looked like it was shot around the streets around here.
Yeah, where our old studio on Ashfield Street was... The buildings around there... Genuinely, it could have been shot around some of those side streets because, like, it absolutely still looks like that today. Like, if you're gonna pick a spot with cobblestone streets and like flat fronted, either like Victorian houses or maybe even older than that, that like are just covered in soot. Yes, that is what it looked like.
Absolutely,
like genuinely, there were a couple of shots from like I think I have walked down that street before at the old studio.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. That's sort of the general taxonomy. So I mean, like the Richardsons are like they're like South London, but they're still kind of Cockneys in the broader sense of the word. So then we get this bit where they're approached by Angelo Bruno of the Philadelphia crime family. I'm reading, who is approaching them on behalf of Myelansky, who was a Jewish gangster.
Correct. Yes.
And I don't know if they really call that mafia or not.
They would call it the Jewish mafia, the Jewish mob. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That absolutely. But yeah. Myelansky, was weird because you brought this up when we were watching it. Lansky was definitely involved in the mob in the 30s, but he was old by this point. But like a lot of these guys had stuck around. Obviously Capone was dead.
So yeah, he approaches them and, he basically is offering them to front them the money to have like an underground gambling ring in exchange for like 50-50 split of the profits.
He offers them worse terms, but Reggie negotiates with him, puts up his extremely hard man front, and Bruno is impressed by him. So, yeah. And then there's an interesting scene where Ronnie basically talks about fucking dudes.
Yeah, because the Italian guy is saying like, hey, whoa, you should come to Philadelphia, get anything you want.
Italian
here,
girl,
pasta,
yeah.
Girls. I love this, like spaghetti, girls. I don't know what else the guys want.
I think
want.
The joke he was making when he said spaghetti and meatballs, he's talking about like a hot Italian chick. I don't think he was specifically talking about spaghetti and meatballs. Yeah.
Yeah. And
some
to be
meatballs
fair,
and some spaghetti, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. No, yeah. The chick with balls. That's right. Got lots of hot trans women. Yeah. You're going to love it. And what's the fucking trans woman then? You gotta come to Philadelphia.
So, I mean, and one thing that might be slightly lost in the subtext here is that in the American mob, if you were gay, that was like a death sentence.
And it still was in Sopranos era. That's like a plot line in Sopranos.
Yeah, in Sopranos, but especially in the I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head. But the American mob boss who got murdered that sort of led to John Gotti becoming the head of the Gambino crime family or establishing dominance over the mob in New York in the 80s. He was killed in a mob hit, and the rumor was that he was gay. And so, like, that absolutely, like, if you were and they found out, you'd die. So the notion of Ronnie admitting that is shocking to a fucking guy from Philly. You know, he likes broads. You don't like fucking guys.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, to be honest, I think the most shocking thing you could offer a Cockney gangster is spaghetti and meatballs, because I can't imagine that either of them would have had any idea what that was. I can remember, like, my mum talking about growing up in like the 50s and 60s in the who's like my mom's parents are both like extremely Cockney, and she's like I didn't have pasta until I was an adult.
Yeah.
And like she's like, I remember she was like, she said that her mum bought spaghetti once, like my grandmother, from the supermarket, and had no idea what to do with it. She was just like snapping it into pieces and putting it in soup.
Mom's grandfather was my great grandfather was a Jewish guy from Woolwich, or her grandmother was a woman from fucking Norwich. And her mom grew up in Norwich and like then married an American guy and moved to America. And one time my mom tried to get, they had had pizza at school and tried to get her mom to make pizza. And she just described it to her. And she said what my mom came up with was basically toast with ketchup and like a slice of cheddar cheese with just like ground beef on top. And I was just like, imagine, to me, like nothing could be more indicative of that generation than being like, describe pizza from experience and what they come back with is just sort of like how an English person would conceive of pizza.
It's a fucking pizza, mate. What's wrong with you? It's bread in it. It's cheese. It's smarter. What more do you want? Cursed British approximations of food. Ronnie goes into all these details about like the different kinds and ethnicities of men he has fucked.
Yes, exactly. And to shock Mr. Bruno, but then Mr. Bruno says basically, I'm impressed.
He's like, being gay. I salute.
I salute. Marone, you have the balls to admit it. Hey, let's toast to being gay. Yeah. It's basically that. We're not really exaggerating.
It's very funny. Hey, look at this guy. Look at this big gay guy over here.
And there is like they don't really beat around the bush in that stuff. And I don't know if this is what Ronnie was like in real life, but there's a scene where Francis, Reggie's love interest and later wife, meets Ronnie for the first time, and he's living in like a, you call it a caravan, wouldn't you? Like we'd say like a trailer or like a camper.
Yeah,
a caravan. And then a dude steps out of the thing, and then he just goes, I'm homosexual. Like it just goes right in. Like he's very, very overtly in your face about like, I am gay. And I don't know how true to life that is, but obviously like that's part of the mythos is that he was.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that
Being gay was still illegal in the UK. I mean, in the 50s, certainly. I think it was 1967 they decriminalized it.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, like, they, maybe it was later than that. It was in the 60s, I believe. But, like, they didn't normalize the age of consent in the UK because it was higher for gay men than for heterosexuals. They didn't normalize it. I want to say until like the fucking 2000s. So like,
I think it. Yeah. I'm not sure it was that late, but yeah. It was a higher age of consent. Yeah, there was all kinds of fucked up laws.
America is different in the sense that like
this was back when it forced British politicians to be more cool because like Tory politicians were always getting caught like having sex in bushes in the park. That was my favorite Winston Churchill story about the one of his ministers had been caught like having gay sex in Hyde Park. It was like February or something. And then supposedly the guy comes in and tells Churchill this. And then Churchill's just like, wasn't it dreadfully cold last night? And he's like, yes, it was the coldest night of the year. And he's like, makes you proud to be British, doesn't it?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes, I mean, I have always been taken aback by, if you look at like the social mores and such and the way that like people were, you know, regularly tormented and outed as being gay and like prosecuted for it. You look at someone like Alan Turing and someone like that. But then, you know, you also read the memoirs of somebody like Robert Graves, and he talks about like anyone of Graves' generation who grew up in the same class as Graves, like will have a story about going to public school and like being, you know, in some kind of a homosexual relationship. Like, that was just sort of a thing that happened. And this is weird because, like, that is kind of a stereotype, I think, that people who know stuff about, not British people who know stuff about British culture have. And I think, in a way, it's weird because I don't know if they're, put it this way, you wouldn't have been able to be a mob guy and be openly gay in America in the 60s. Mm. And a lot, I mean, obviously because of the fact that, like, well, a lot of these guys, like, came from communities that were super religious and stuff like that, but also, like, the whole macho shit, too. I mean, the problem is the Italians. it's not what I'm actually saying, but, I mean, more than anything else, like, the idea of there being a gay gangster, it's not that it's unthinkable, it's just that in that, you know, the same time period in America.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of anything that was...
So according to, supposedly in his own words, Ronnie Crane is, in his various, like, books and interviews, has said that he's bisexual, but he was married to 3 women at various points, all while he was in prison in Broadmoor. So, yeah, I mean, I suspect that it probably wasn't, like, super open. I mean, very much the way they portray it in the film is that, like, he enjoys telling people it because, like, he knows that he's such a psycho that they won't say anything about it. Like, that his whole, like, they're like, well, you can't really be homophobic around this guy because he will just hit you with a hammer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I was thinking
it's certainly one way of doing gay rights.
It's just interesting, too, because this is a thing that I've noticed, that oftentimes when they'll do these big budget, big studio biopics of people who are gay or bisexual or whatever, it's rare that they're actually ever depicted in any kind of, like, love interest, like, actual physical contact. You know what I mean? Like he goes around this entire film just being like, "I'm homosexual," but never kisses a man, never has, there's no, like, love, any kind of scene. Like, he has these, like, hanger-on boys, but, like, he basically
sort of implied that he's shagging Teddy, isn't it?
Yeah, but, like, they just don't, aside from him lighting their cigarettes, there's literally nothing.
Yeah.
Hilariously, I saw the Elton John biopic.
Sex wasn't invented in Britain until 1970.
Exactly. Yeah. The reason why...
Even gay sex was just like, you strip down to your pants, you have a little cuddle, you light a cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. You quiz each other on Greek and Roman mythology, and that's it. That's being gay in boarding school.
That is right, yeah.
Yeah, and so, which is interesting because, I mean, like, I don't think Tom Hardy is, like, particularly openly bi, but, like, he was more or less outed by the fact that he had, like, total gay thought pics and stuff and listed himself as bisexual on, like, MySpace before he'd become famous.
Oh, MySpace?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the Tom Hardy thought ass pics, but yes.
No.
And I mean, he's a good-looking guy, let's be honest here.
Has Tom Hardy got cake? Is that what we're dealing with?
Oh, God. Yes. And this is a film.
I can tell these photos made an impression on Nate.
Well, I mean, this is a film that's basically a vehicle for Tom Hardy to, like, look hot the entire time. But it is interesting to me that sort of contrast between it's in your face that I'm gay, but there's no acknowledgement whatsoever that, like, he is sexually attracted to men. You'd almost think, if you didn't know anything about it, that he was just telling people that to freak them out.
If you didn't know anything about
the story.
Because, like, equally, though, the way that Reggie is portrayed, like, he's also very sexless. Like, he has this relationship with Francis, but there's never, like, any...
It's like his first crush, practically, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's, never any, like, intimacy between them, really, of any kind.
It's mostly him kissing her to apologize after he's done something fucked up or his brother has done something fucked up.
Yeah. And it's that... And in some ways, I feel like that might be quite accurate. I feel like so many... There is just a certain, like, sexlessness to British culture, which is, like...
It's weird because I think we have this impression of British people as being really, really buttoned up about stuff, but I think...
it's not prudish, it's different. It's just kind of...
If anything, it's probably a little more openly bawdy, and we've talked about this on other episodes, like with drugs, people are way more open about drug use here. Mm. Like, Americans are prudish and Puritan about certain things. It's just, like, I think maybe the reason why British people have this reputation is because the things that make us uncomfortable don't make British people uncomfortable, but the things that make us, that we don't bat an eye at, would make British people incredibly uncomfortable. Talking about your personal life with someone you don't really know, that's like British kryptonite. Whereas
I feel like the most powerful, like, British guy energy, and particularly, like, geezer hard man energy, is to be like, I have a hot girlfriend because, like, that's like a Chad thing to do, but also it's gay to get pussy. So like, I don't have sex with her.
Yeah, I just gay. Bully her on my viral videos.
Yeah, she just comes out with me, and then we sleep in bed with like a big fucking Mormon bed sheet stretched taut between us. You know.
Well, I mean, I think about it too that there's also the sort of reputation. I think, you know, British guy goes to California and is shocked by the openness kind of thing. But like, not all Americans are that overt. Like, we are probably a people more so, certainly more so than the British, and certainly more so than like upper class English people. But I mean, like, British people, you get them drunk or high enough, they'll start telling you about their fucking life. You know what I mean? Like, it's not so buttoned up as to like necessitate the stereotype. Maybe it was more so in the olden days, but I mean, considering how many American servicemen just fucking like fathered children because they were just nailing people in alleyways and shit, like, it couldn't have been that buttoned up. Britain is a very deeply horny country. That, I feel like.
That is very true. I mean, you know, if we went back to the story of my mother's parents, two deeply horny people, as it turned out.
Well, I mean, my mother's parents, you know, American airman who's like 21 and like 16-year-old schoolgirl in Norfolk, and like, they got married like 3 weeks before my mom was born.
Problematic age gap there.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Well, but, Nate, when are you going to answer for your grandfather's problematic age gap with your grandmother? Cancelled.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, well, I think I've probably mentioned this even on Britannology before, but like, there's like this weird tradition in my family that when you're like 16, 17, you get to find out that like your grandparents were having affairs your entire life, and that like that guy that you thought was granddad's friend, no, woman, rather. The guys were grandma's friends. If my grandparents had also been gay, that would have been a hell of a story. I just remember that my nan had this this one guy who she was obviously like fucking or whatever when I was a kid, called Dennis, who would sometimes be there like hanging out if she picked me up from school or something. And I remember being like, it's like one of my earliest memories. I was probably like 5 or something, like really young. And I remember this guy, just all I really remember about him was he had a mustache and he absolutely stinked of Benson and Hedges. Like, this is a man who was like caning cigarettes all day long. And he tried to convince me that he'd been in the SAS. And even at 5, I was like, I didn't even really know what the SAS was, but I'm like, nah, nah, bullshit.
5-year-old Milo doing a Stolen Valor video on this guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would say there is definitely a reputation for stuff being more buttoned up here. And I think that the thing about it is too, is it, well, I don't really think a lot of Americans, in however as much as people conceive of sort of swinging London, associate that with the craze or that kind of shit. That feels like kind of niche trivia. Like, I remember hearing about Ronnie Cray because of a lyric to a Blur song, the song Charmless Man, when I was a teenager, but because I was a huge fucking Tiaboo. We know this. That's why I live in this stupid country.
That's why we do this podcast.
That's why we do this podcast. But yeah. But I think that, like,
it's ironic because the Krays were huge Oasis guys.
Really?
No.
That would have been hilarious if, like, from prison they were writing fan letters to, like, fucking Liam Gallagher.
They're both wearing Adidas Gazelles in prison.
But people would probably more likely associate it with stuff like the Beatles, or the Rolling Stones, or Pink Floyd, or the sort of just psychedelic shit in general, you know, stuff like that. I mean, if you look at album sales, it might be the Beatles and the Monkees, and that's about it. You know what I mean? But it's more like that sort of undercurrent of the sort of British gangster thing. There was never really, there have been times when there have been, like, call them crazes, if you will, where people have really gotten into British stuff in America. Hugh Grant movies, Richard Curtis movies, stuff like kind of cult things like Monty Python or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, stuff like that. Not even counting Austin Powers, because obviously it's a parody of all of that.
Yeah, but, classic.
You know, or things like TV adaptations of Jane Austen novels and things
like
that.
I like to think that Austin Powers isn't a parody of James Bond. It's just about a different guy who works at the same office. Like, he just has a very different take on the procedure.
Well, it's funny to me because I remember when the Austin Powers films came out and I was old enough to sort of like get the jokes being made in the sense that I was like almost 13 when the first one came out.
It's a horny age.
But the thing about it is, though, is that what I didn't realize, and from editing Kill James Bond, I've learned this, is that everything in in Austin Powers is a specific spoof of shit in the early Bond films.
Because
I never really, still to this day, haven't seen that many of them, and I don't really fucking feel like I'm missing out on that much.
I think I've seen almost all of them, but probably not every single one.
I've seen, oh my God, I have a funny Bond. Okay, so I've seen GoldenEye when it came out because that was huge. That was like classic. A great, good movie.
All the Brosnan ones are great. I mean, the Die Another Day is a bit dubious, but it's still like an amusing film.
I saw all of the Bond movies with Brosnan, and I saw, what is it? I can't remember what the first one was with Daniel Craig.
Casino Royale,
that's the only one. And then I've seen Moonraker because it's absurd.
Oh yeah, fuck yeah!
Fucking space marines fighting in outer space with lasers. And I've also seen A View to a Kill because it has
Duran Duran
singing the song. It has James Caan as the villain. Like, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
However,
it has the two like Amazonian twins as the henchmen.
Good shit.
Along with Jaws.
So when I was probably about 17. Mm-hmm. You've met my friend Spencer, the Korean-American guy.
Yeah.
We grew up together. He called me one day and he's like, dude, this is so stupid. But like, my mom and her friends from church have decided that I should like have a play date with other fucking Korean kids. And he's like, could you come over? And I was like, yeah, man. What's up? He's like, 'cause it's so weird. I was like, yeah, what's up? And he's like, well, it's me. It's two girls who are like 12, who are like, obviously, like we were like 16 or 17.
Yeah.
He's like, and it's Jay. Jay Han was a drug dealer.
Oh, okay.
From our hometown, who, if I remember correctly, drove a BMW he had bought with drug money. He told his parents he worked at a grocery store. He one time bought his brother like $1,000 worth of Gundam toys just because he could. He made great rap mixtapes that like my buddy used to buy
that
off
kid's
him.
Brother Hussein Kazvani.
And so Jay was there, and we came over, and like Jay was just being himself and like reacting to the Bond film.
Right, okay.
And I just remember sitting with him. That this is the one memory I have of whatever the film it was. I think it was You Only Live Twice. Mm-hmm. Jay goes, you know, man, you know James Bond gotta have fucking A's, right?
Isn't like, You Only Live Twice the one with all the yellow face?
Probably.
The Korean
remember.
Family being like, which Bond film is the most racist about Asians?
Well, why would you make your kids watch a 35-year-old Bond film? Like, it's weird. Anyway, he goes, you know, man, James gotta have A's or some shit, right? Because like, look at this fucking guy, right? Like, he's like, the girls are like, yo, James, wear latex. And he's like, nah, bitch, I'm hitting it raw tonight. Just like, who the fuck is this guy?
James L. Jones Bond.
Yeah. So, yes, that's my Bond story that is completely off track from the craze. But the bigger point I was making was that this kind of current, I don't know, and I'm asking you, is that a big thing people associate with like 60s London? You know, because like if you talk about like 60s Las Vegas or 70s Las Vegas in America, like the mob shit is undeniable.
And if you
talk about New York in like, well, any Chicago in Prohibition or New York like in around the same time, like so much of that kind of like Godfather shit or like Al Capone shit, you know what I mean? Like that is a thing people associate with it.
I think because London is so, and I would say that like probably, and New York probably has a bit the same thing where because they're such massive global cities and there's so many things associated with them from a particular time, it doesn't stick. Whereas like with like Chicago or Vegas, it does because they're like smaller cities where there was kind of less stuff going on. And particularly Vegas, like it's just casinos. So whoever's running the casinos is very much going to be like the figure of the day. And so, I get that. But yeah, I think in London, there was just so much other stuff going on. Like the craze are definitely like a cultural reference point in a lot of stuff, which I think is worth talking about. But yeah, I don't think it was. And I think broadly speaking, in the 60s, the craze weren't something that like affected your life, particularly, even if you lived in the East End. Like it was mostly, as I think, like broadly speaking, the mafia was too. It was kind of like gangsters who were like doing shit with other gangsters. It's kind of like if you're not a criminal, you're not really.
They might hit
with
you
it.
Up for protection money, which you obviously your life was easier if you paid. The cops were corrupt and taking bribes from them and shit like that. But it wasn't as if, you know,
the filth.
Yeah, you were you know, you weren't living in like an occupied territory. It's just, it was a thing that existed.
Yeah, exactly. And so as a result, like a lot of British people from that era and even like younger have this like really sort of romanticized vision of what the sort of like East End gangsters were like. I mean, particularly the craze because they're the most kind of pop culture-y figures, but that kind of that whole thing about like, oh, they were good to their mum. Say what you like about Ronnie and Reggie. And because they did have all these people defending them in the media, like people like Barbara Windsor, who would just like casually mention that they were like mates with them, whatever. I can remember when we used to go on holiday a lot to Spain when I was a kid. and to a part of Spain where there were like lots of Brits, and there was but we used to go to a place like up in the mountains, but there was this restaurant up there called the Valparaiso that I think was owned by some like old East End types, and it was always like full of like East End gangsters who had like fled to Spain. That was like a big thing that people used to do. I mean, that was like what Ronnie Biggs and a lot of the train robbers, they went to Spain for a while. I think Ronnie Biggs went to Brazil for a bit, like, but that was a big thing, like, because you couldn't get extradited from Spain at some point, and then like the EU kind of made some changes to that. But yeah, so then there was the whole thing of like all the gangsters down the coast. But again, like sort of celebrities would like go and hang out at the Valparaiso with these guys. And it was always like a sort of romanticized cultural thing of like, well, they're criminals, but they're kind of like, they're the sort of like the honorable gentleman criminals. It's a bit like the way we now, you know, if you compare Al-Qaeda and ISIS, you know, you sort of, you look back on Al-Qaeda as the kind of gentleman terrorists, you know, doing things in a refined way, looked after their mums.
Yeah. Well, yeah, specifically the they looked after their mums thing seems to be like a... like a touchstone.
It's like a meme about the craze, kind of.
I've seen it. Yeah, I feel as though I've seen it referenced in stuff, sort of like explaining away the fact that like they did murder people. They themselves personally murdered people. They didn't have lots of people killed, because I feel like it's pretty much a given that America is just a much more violent country. And so as a result, like there were probably more mob killings, but by and large, mob killings were like confined to other mob people.
Yeah. And you see this a lot in the film as well, that like the craze are sort of, they're like, they're most often, they're just kind of like roughing people up a bit. There's not a lot of murder. And usually when there is a murder, there's usually a bunch of people going, what the fuck are you done that for?
Yeah, it's weird because someone explained this to me about Korean gangsters and stuff, because that's a famous sort of thing about Korea, was that they had a lot of sort of their equivalent to the Yakuza kind of shit. And it's sort of like, it's almost never happens that someone gets killed, because if someone gets murdered, then it's like, well, then the cops feel obligated to put someone in prison for it.
Yeah,
whereas like if you just beat the shit out of people or like stab them, but non-fatally, then, you know, you get your point across, but it's not really taking up too much time, you know, in the cops' attention.
Exactly.
And it's just, in the same vein as like, if you watch a movie comparable, let's say Serpico or something like that. The whole point of Serpico is like this one cop who dared to be like, actually the NYPD is corrupt as fuck and everyone's on the take from the mob. And then they got shot by his fellow cops. Like that's a true story.
Oh,
that was like
surprise.
In the 60s or the early 70s, yeah. I think the film came out in the early 70s, but the story takes place in the
60s. Al Pacino, isn't it?
Yeah. And so...
it's been a mob film that Al Pacino is not in.
I was going to say, Jesus Christ, yeah. Yeah, flashing back, I was going to say, I don't think he's in Casino.
No.
I think that's Robert De Niro, but one of the two of them.
He's not in Goodfellas, I don't think.
No, but De Niro is, I think...
Yeah, De Niro is, yeah.
Ray Liotta is, yeah. Joe Pesci is. Joe Pesci, classic. Just real real shit right there. Damn, son, where'd you find this? Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of a running thing through it, is this sort of like slightly, again, just this vibe. I mean, we talk about this a lot, but how like Britain is kind of a low stakes country. And that even the sort of like, the guy, Jack the Hat like steals from them, and then like Reggie just punches him in the face and he's like, don't do it again. And it's kind of like, yeah, you feel like if that had happened even in The Sopranos, like that guy would absolutely have been murdered. And so that there is that kind of, which I think is like sort of a fair representation of it, because I think a lot of like British criminals time immemorial, a lot of the focus is on like kind of you're paying the cops off, but there's only like so much you can get away with. So they're kind of trying to exist in this. They've got this like kind of, vibe going. I know that during the supposedly, like much like the American Rob, they had a lot of hookups in construction.
Yeah.
And a lot of, so it, basically in Britain, there weren't really any motorways until like the 1960s. I think they built the M1 in the late 50s, which was hence the name, the first one.
First one, yeah.
Which goes from like London to Leeds, basically. But in this period, like the kind of the late 50s, 60s, 70s was when they were building a lot of like the major arterial motorways. And supposedly the craze were like concreting bodies into the motorway, like the structures of flyovers and stuff, because like they knew this would just never be found. They're not going to fucking dismantle an arterial motorway to see if there's a body in there. But yeah, supposedly that was what was going on. I don't know how true that is or whether that's like a rumor. So they're in this thing with the American mob. Ronnie kills an associate of the Richardsons, George Cornell, in a pub by just walking in and shooting him in the head. Yeah. And again, just cue various of the minor Crane forces going, "What the fuck you done that for, Ron?" And then he just like calmly goes around to his mum and dad's house and is like eating cake. And Reggie comes in and is like attempting to remonstrate with him, but like without like really revealing to their mother what they're talking about.
Because they love their moms. They
don't exactly,
want, they
yeah.
Wanna, they don't want to upset yeah. them.
And their mum's just busting around going, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he's like, "That would be lovely, thank you, mother." So then they send, he like sends a bunch of guys to like intimidate witnesses, like burn Ronnie's clothes or whatever. Like Ronnie is refusing to take it seriously. And this is like one of the few parts where it's acknowledged that Ronnie actually fucks, where, he's insists that he's staying over at his mother's. And then his mum is like, turns to Teddy and is like, "Would you like to stay with him?" And he's like, "Oh yes, that'd be lovely. Thank you." Teddy is like an absolute twink.
There's also another one too who I can't remember. There's another blonder guy as well, but yes, Teddy is just is his sort of like twink on his arm the entire film.
You wouldn't like to think about what Ronnie Cray does to Teddy. Teddy looks like he's of a delicate disposition.
Ronnie makes it very clear in the beginning that he is always a top and never a bottom. Mm. There's the whole thing with the Tory Lord and them having like weird sex parties.
Oh, yeah, because he's trying to build this African city. So they're trying to get this Tory Lord Booth, a real guy who was really involved with the Crays.
The most sexual thing that winds up happening is them screening a gay porn film at his flat and him like spanking a guy with a big wicker paddle. But like once again,
everyone's wearing like baggy Y fronts. It's like the most like unsexual. It's like a gay sex party, but everyone just looks like the gym changing room. And like not in a good way.
I saw the Elton John biopic on a plane and they'd censored all the sex scenes, and apparently that's the
can't have people getting horny on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently that's also when they released the film theatrically in Russia. They had to show that cut.
They cut out all the drugs and all the sex. Because I remember hearing that, because that film came out about the time I was leaving Russia. And someone said, apparently they've cut out all the drugs and all the sex. And that's going to be a short fucking film about Elton John. Like, we've just cut out the 1970s and 80s. Like, they're just gone.
Yeah, exactly. Once again, I mean, this film's portrayal of Ronnie's sexuality made me think of that no sex allowed cut on the plane.
Yeah, it was very odd. It's weird. They don't really try and develop anything with Teddy. They never even really make it explicit that they're like dating or whatever, other than the sort of like nods to the fact that there's clearly something going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of implied he's around a lot, and Ronnie hasn't killed him, and he's a twink, so...
The likelihood is, as Michael York would say, he's getting sucked off by a twink.
One can presume.
Yeah.
But you do never see this on screen.
Yeah, so they're now under like an intense investigation because Ronnie's murdered this guy. There's an amazing line in the Wikipedia summary here, which is, "Reg's marriage with Francis crumbles due to his addiction to crime." Oh, I'm simply addicted to crime. He's a professional criminal. He's not addicted to crime. It's just like what he does for a living.
Bloody relapsed on crime again.
Oh, what a 12-step program for crime. Last night, I was close to knocking off a butcher's. I had to call me sponsor.
AA for crime.
Yeah. I found myself about to have gay sex in a park, and I had to remind myself of the steps. phoning up people you've extorted money from and apologizing.
Got to make amends one way or the other. I mean, so basically, their relationship crumbles. It's implied that Reggie is drinking more heavily. He winds up beating up Francis.
Yeah.
She leaves him. She goes to stay with her brother. He decides to try to reconcile with her. They agree to go to Ibiza together. I refuse to pronounce it the Cockney way.
Ibiza.
Yeah. And
kind of Ibiza.
And then instead of going to Ibiza with him, she overdoses on pills and dies. But she's the narrator of the film, so we then learn this moment that she's narrating it from beyond the grave.
Yeah. Which is, you know, that's the kind of high sex technology they have in films these days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then he goes down for murdering Jack the Hat.
Yeah,
after Jack the Hat gets paid by Ronnie to murder their sort of like fixer accountant, lawyer accountant guy.
The Nick the accountant of the Cray situation. Shout out to Nick the accountant.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Nick. We promise we will never do that.
Yeah, no, that is not on the cards.
Basically, they Ronnie pays Jack the Hat to shoot the accountant, but he fails to kill him.
Jack the Hat is like the comedy criminal who can never get anything right. So it's like very funny.
He's the guy who's, when we tell you that he's punching people in the face, it's really just that guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just he's always like, oh, I've ballsed it up again and he's punching me in the bloody mouth.
And so then for some reason, Jack the Hat, maybe this is right at the moment that cocaine was introduced to the UK. I have no idea.
His breeding population of cocaine was introduced into the UK.
Unlike his usual hangdog apologetic self, he's just kind of like aggressively provocative with Reggie at a party when Reggie's like, what the fuck did you do that for? So Reggie puts a gun to his head and dares him to say, after he makes fun of him for his wife dying, dares him to say her name again. He does. He pulls the trigger. There's no bullets in the gun, so he grabs a knife from a cake and stabs him to death.
Oh, I forgot my fucking bullets.
And I will say that this is unlike normal movie stabbings. Like, this seems like a real psycho stabbing. He stabs him like 100 times.
Yeah, and it's pretty... it's like one of the... I mean, I don't know. I think we're all pretty desensitized to like film violence at this point, but it's one of the ones where you watch it and you're like, oh... Yeah, that looks unpleasant.
That looks really unpleasant. Like, I wouldn't want that to happen. Yeah.
Unlike the shootings in the film, which are mostly like...
Yeah,
just like little like, oh, yeah, there's an hole in mid. Oh, yeah. I've fallen over.
Yeah. Like, he shoot when Ronnie shoots the guy George in the pub, George like smirks at him before falling over.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, not really how it works.
No.
But, yeah.
What I love is that there are so many incidents in the film of people getting murdered and then they're just being just like general, just like ordinary people around who are like, oh, fucking hell. Like, they're just not reacting with like the requisite amount of terror. Like, guy gets shot in the head in the pub and there's just like some guys that can have like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Oh, mate, you got a fucking mopping bucket.
Yeah. They're coming all the way over from Australia. Now you're murdering someone. Oh, there's been heaps of murders around here. This guy gets shot in the head. It's truth.
Exactly. Anyway, so
walking into a pub, so like, oh, good morning, Ronnie.
Yeah, long story short, they the movie's denouement is basically he gets arrested, Reggie gets arrested, the cops come and break his door down and arrest him. It's said that he died in prison. Well, he died after compassionate release from prison, but
yeah,
the entire 33 years he was in prison before his death in 2000, he apparently carried the tickets on him for him and Francis to go to Ibiza together, because once again, their romance is portrayed like it's his first crush or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Ronnie...
Apparently they only knew each other for like 2 years. I'm reading in...
Ronnie gets sent back to prison, or rather he's recertified as insane and he died in a facility in 1995.
Yeah, Broadmoor, which is like the big secure, high security mental hospital in Britain.
Is that sort of like, that's like where like
that's where like all Myra the infamous, Hindley and, yeah, Myra Hindley was in there for a bit. I don't know if she stayed in there, but yeah, like lots of really famous British murderers have been certified insane, isn't there? Yeah, and of course all British gangsters always die before the age of 70 because all they do is smoke cigarettes and like eat processed meat. Like, it is just endless, like eating a fry up, smoking a cigarette, drinking a pint. Like, there is, I don't know how any of them ever shat. Like, they consume no fiber at any point in the film. And I think that's an accurate portrayal.
So yeah, basically the film ends implying that
I don't bottom because my arsehole seized up.
Yeah, that's Milo hacking and coughing because even though he doesn't smoke or drink pints or eat fry-ups with the same frequency as your garden variety British guy, he is still related to them genetically.
I'm doing the accurate because you got it. When you listen to Dave Courtney, you can hear the years of cigarettes in the throat there.
Yeah, it's a weird frog in the throat voice for a frog-like guy.
You have to sort of like, you have to have like a narrow, like a thin but wide mouth shape to do the Dave Courtney voice. Like, you're sort of grimacing. That's the...
But then again, thus ends the Tom Hardy hotness vehicle that is Legend.
Yeah, looking pretty good as Reggie and more weird as Ronnie.
Yeah, more psychotic as Ronnie.
Yeah, it's quite an impressively done like thing of like having him play both parts, and he does look different as both of them, but also similar enough. Because actually, when you look at the two Kray twins, they did look really similar. I've got this picture here. This picture looks so much like an album cover of like an album Nate would send me.
though to be fair, yeah, they do absolutely look way more just British in that photo than someone like Tom Hardy, let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
Born in Haggerston, is it?
Yeah, Haggerston, round the corner. Fucking Paul Bettany was in this. Paul Bettany was Charlie Richardson.
Not sure I know who that is.
Paul Bettany.
Paul Bettany, yeah.
Paul Bettany was in Margin Call, Wimbledon. What else is? Oh, he played the Unabomber in the Unabomber TV series. I don't know. He's been in lots of stuff. He's a British actor. He's like, and fucking Christopher Eccleston as the cop that's chasing Nipper Reed. Apparently, also a real guy. If I was like the feared cop, I wouldn't want my nickname to be Nipper.
It also feels like Nipper's henchman is also sort of a similar twink figure who's always in the car.
Oh yeah, there's
him.
Like the little cop who has to wear a uniform, whereas Nipper's just big northern guy wearing a big tweed suit. There was that weird, and I don't know how accurate this is, but there is that weird conception at the time of like the police almost being like a rival gang to the gangs, and like the way that they interact with each other is like sort of intimidation and stuff. Whereas I don't really know how accurate that is.
It is definitely true in America still.
Yeah.
As we
have
seen.
American police not behaving themselves. What a surprise. And Frances is played by Emily Browning, who I can't remember what else I've seen her in, but she is hot.
Yes, if you're into,
well, she's Australian. There you go.
Yeah, see, exactly. You
Crikey.
Can you can always suss out an Australian everywhere.
Good
you
morning,
go.
Reggie. that would have been fun if they just made her do her like regular accent. Well, anyway, Emily Browning, DM me. But
that being said,
Tom Hardy, DM Nate.
Hey, you know what? You know what?
We just want to ask what you're doing with all that cake.
Exactly. Like, I just want the outtakes of those MySpace thought pictures that you posted in, like, 2003 or whenever the fuck.
Yeah. It's just all the Toms. Usher, Hardy, they've all got cake, you know?
Just fucking yams. Yams left and right.
Yams!
So, I suppose having seen the film and talked a little bit about the legend, as it were, we should just sort of maybe end on... What is the cultural significance of this kind of thing now? Because I feel like Guy Ritchie stuff, movies like Layer Cake, even some of the bullshit, weirder, like TV streaming series is like Gangs of London, are in many ways kind of playing off of that, but just making it more flashy or showy or updating it or that kind of a thing.
It's a certain kind of like, I think it, I mean, it does have that thing in movies where I think that like it's been like updated by people like Guy Ritchie into a more stylized thing, but there's also like there's just a certain it inhabits a large part of the minds of geezers, like guys who now live in Essex and like they own a roofing company, but they just love the craze. And it's very, I think it's kind of, it's a southern thing. It's not, I don't really think you get it up north. I think that's kind of a different pathology, but yeah, guys who just like, they love the, I remember like there's a fish and chip shop in Harlow. It's a really good fish and chip shop, and it is run by Essex Guido Italians. Essex is the New Jersey of the United Kingdom.
You have to specify that. And that's also where Milo is from. So
yeah, it's full of Italians. It's got the same, but it's like very, the British equivalent of a wall, which is oi mate. All the guys who like, you know, left London because, you know, too ethnically diverse or whatever, or they wanted a big fuck off house, the same as all the people who left New York and went to New Jersey. And then now it's all like second generation left New York families but have all this like romantic idea of themselves as like Brooklyn gangsters or whatever.
Yeah, fair.
But yeah, in this fish and chip shop, they redid it and they had this huge mural put on the wall which contained loads of like, it was like, we're British, like British references. I think I might have a photo of it somewhere, but it's amazing. It's got like a bulldog on there. It's got like Churchill. It's got the flag of the Royal Navy for some reason, but it's got the craze on there. It has one of the graphics on there, which is absolutely amazing and sent me, is a graphic of the UK and EU flags, like with a like photoshopped in rip like between them. So like half the flag is Britain, half the flag is EU, with 52% and 48% written on them. Brexit references.
What would really make me laugh is if they had the Krage friends in a memorial, but they're like a on a wall, but they also had a memorial to Lee Rigby and be like, no, see, brutal crime is only...
Lee Rigby is on there.
Oh, fuck's sake!
With like an angelic halo background.
Oh my fucking God, you're joking.
I didn't remember, but then you said it.
Oh my fucking God. I've lived here too long!
You're beginning to understand. Now, let the Britain flow through you.
For the purposes of people who aren't familiar with the story, Lee Rigby was I believe he was a bandsman in the British Army who was murdered on the street in Woolwich by two self-declared ISIS guys who were like British Nigerians who had, they attacked him on the street. And
yeah, it was pretty nasty. They like beheaded him with a machete or something. But it is now just like...
It is a co-celebre of the most insane people in this country.
Absolutely, yeah. And whenever they want to bring up anything, it's always Lee Rigby.
If you see Lee Rigby's face on something, it's basically... The person is...
It's always like, warning, this person is insane.
Yeah, they are insane, and they hate immigrants. Yes, that the fact that he's in the same mural as the Cray twins, who probably would have beheaded someone if they hadn't had other ways of killing them. Hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
Britain. Britain, that's all it is.
Would it be Eddie Salmon, but only if he was a nonce. Right.
So anyway, I don't really know if there's much else to go on. I mean, the film's... You know,
yeah. Decent. Other than like these, it's a decent film. It's worth a watch if you're looking for a film to watch. It's an entertaining film. Definitely these guys are like they're absolutely real, and it's like interesting. I think this is an interesting follow up to the Dave Courtney episode in the sense of like Dave Courtney is like trying to pass him off as like part of that world. And like it's not to say that world didn't exist, but rather that like it does have like a huge amount of hangers on.
And those guys were long since in prison by the time that Dave Courtney got involved in his crime shit. He was doing crime shit in the very late 70s and early 80s, and then not too long after that retired from crime shit. So like the Krays had been in prison at that point for 12, 13, 14 years.
And there's lots of people who, like, for example, someone who genuinely did work with the Krays is Lenny the Governor McLean, who died in, like, he died shortly after Lockstock was made. He was Barry the Baptist in Lockstock. But he wasn't a criminal. He was, like, a bare-knuckle boxer and also a doorman. So he worked in a lot of the Krays clubs as a doorman. So there's lots of people like that who, like, weren't exactly criminals, but they were like involved with that criminal world because they were like doormen or boxers or whatever. Because so much of the money was in unlicensed boxing and stuff like that.
Or you have people like Vinnie Jones, who was a professional footballer and like a construction worker, but
just a bit rough.
He was just sort of this guy who was around people like that.
This fucking guy. Yeah, I mean, just a story about Lenny the Governor McLean. There's an amazing interview, I think you could probably find it on YouTube, of Lenny the Governor McLean in like the late 90s, where he's like sat out the back of his house. It's like the most fucking British guy dream ever. He's got like a concrete statue of a bulldog next to him. This is like huge beer gut lying on a sun lounger with a mirror, like directing the sun onto himself, taking an interview from this BBC guy who's asking him about like his days working with the Krays, and he's like, he said, oh, yeah, through the door at the Acne Hippodrome and that. And then they're like, oh, right. And then they were like, Lenny, what was the worst fight you ever got involved in on the door? And he's like, well, once these about 14 blokes showed up and they I wasn't letting them in. So they set about me. He's like, thing is, I'm a nice guy. If you're a nice guy, I'm a nice guy. But if you want to be a tough guy, I'm a fucking animal. You can just see this like guy becoming more and more concerned. And he's like, yeah, so they set about me. And, we got into it. And they're like, well, then what happened? And he's like, well, I knocked 7 of them out. The other 7 ran off. And then he's like, how did you knock 7 of them out? And he's like, well, I had a stick. And he's like, a stick? And he's like, yeah, we used to keep a stick behind the door in case things got a bit tasty.
Just like, you know, because you need to know.
Exactly. just got a big fucking pickaxe handle behind the door. That's the most British criminal thing ever, is just having a fucking pickaxe handle as a weapon. Because, no, I'm actually surprised how much in this film there was of, like, portraying people using guns. Because, like, you look at stuff from the Great Train Robbery, which was, like, the biggest heist in Britain of that era. Like, they were literally just using pickaxe handles. And if they got charged with murder because one of the guys, they hit him too hard with the pickaxe handle and he died. But I don't think they shot anyone. It was like kind of like, you can't imagine that happening in America, like a huge robbery like that. And they're just armed with like bits of wood. But like, it's the most powerful British energy.
Not even a sharp piece of metal on the piece of wood, just pieces of wood.
Yeah. I've got a geezer with a big piece of wood. And if you don't stop that train, he'll hit you with it. They're like, oh, fair enough, mate. That is quite a large piece of wood.
God damn it. Fuck's sake. Well, you know what? If you don't want to be hit in the head with a large piece of wood, then please do not come within, I think, 3 or 4 degrees east or west of the Greenwich Meridian, of the Prime Meridian.
Yeah.
Because this is a country of geezers who will hit you with objects.
Yeah.
And they take their inspiration from the Cray twins.
Yeah.
And
don't come around Whitechapel or we'll hit you with a trash shoot your pickaxe handle. All right, son. Oh, legally, we will not do that.
Legally, we are not allowed to threaten you.
That is a joke, not a threat.
So anyway, once again, Milo, it's been a pleasure.
As always.
And we will catch you next time.
We love to learn about Britain. Bye-bye.